We'll hear argument now in the case of United States against Thompson. Don't take it personally that you've caused the entire courtroom to flee, Mr. Hurley.
It's not a unique experience in my practice here. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Wisconsin statute and administrative code require that in the procurement process, one obtain for the state a qualified product at the lowest possible price, and in the end, that is precisely what the state got.
So just to clarify, I took this from your brief, that in the end, the Edelman bid was, in fact, the low bid?
It was. I will give the government the benefit of the evidence. While Mr. Webb, who
That's
had...
prudent thing to do.
while Mr. Webb, who had scored the two in the end, said it was a tie, the government pointed out at trial that Mr. Webb left out a decimal point, seven.
Oh, this is a 0.7 difference in the scoring?
In the score out of 1,200, there was a six thousandth of 1% difference between the two.
My understanding is that mostly that had to do with service. I mean, I thought Edelman was unambiguously the cheapest.
That is correct.
And then there was an argument that it was cheap and it was also not going to provide as much service, so you had to decide value for money.
Well, if one looks at it as a 600th of 1/6000th of 1% difference in service,
well, you
the
can't
object
get more
is
significant
a,
digits out than you put in, so
it is a qualified product. We had two qualified products. One was a significantly lower price. And the,
now, my only question, actually, I was, in fact, speaking about the dollars, because this 1,200-point scale included not only dollars, but as Judge Easterbrook said, you know, service, and did you like somebody in the oral presentation, and all of these other factors. I realize at the end of the day, after this last and best offer, they were both within tenths of 1027, right?
They were, there was a 0.7 difference.
And 1026.6, if I remember.
Right. There was a 0.7, right. 0.7 difference in total score out of 1,200.
So, your, I guess maybe the legal point I would appreciate a word from you on is why this didn't fall within the misallocation of state funds branch, if you will, of 666. The government says, well, you're talking about the wrong subsection or you're the wrong part of it. State funds went to Edelman because of what Ms. Thompson did, allegedly.
Its theory, as stated in the indictment, was that it was a misappropriation of funds under 666 for precisely the same reasons that it says it was a theft of honest services. That she used criteria other than those that were in the evaluator's handbook, and that led to the misappropriation. That was the government's theory. I don't believe that states a proper theory of misappropriation in this case. I don't believe that there was any misappropriation of funds premised upon that.
So number one, you're saying there's no misappropriation of funds anyway, I guess.
That
number
is correct.
And you're making the argument that given her position as a member of this six-person committee, she wasn't appropriating or misappropriating anything? She's persuading. She's urging people to go with Edelman, certainly. You'd have
correct.
To admit that.
The issue, as I'd frame it here, are can charges for misappropriation or the theft of honest services and conviction for those offenses as well be founded on a career civil servant's exercise or performance of a discretionary act when there's no gain to her and no pecuniary loss to the state.
Do you think that there would have been a misappropriation of public services if she had thought that the person making the presentation for Edelman looked like Brad Pitt and therefore she really just wanted them to have the contract?
You know, there were other evaluators who felt that way about Edelman. In other words, they didn't think that Edelman looked like Brad Pitt. They thought he was far more nefarious looking, and therefore stated openly that they didn't like the presentation.
Yeah, but I'm just suggesting if she had had some personal reason to want Edelman to get the contract that didn't show up on the Wisconsin regulations as valid reasons, you know, she just thought that this would be a really great guy to work with because he's very handsome. Would we have this prosecution?
Whether we'd have it depends on the prosecutor and whether they chose to bring it.
Well,
if you're asking, would
asking should we maybe?
No,
you know,
we should. No, we shouldn't. No, what ought be shown here, what ought be proved by the government, is not that she had thoughts about other criteria. In fact, what she is called on to do is to exercise her discretion, that is, use her experience and knowledge, subjectively against an objective set of criteria in order to arrive at a recommendation.
So what should we make, though, of these comments that she says, you know, that the people she works for aren't going to be very happy, you know, if Edelman isn't chosen, and words to that effect?
Well, first, nobody recalled that those were her words.
Yeah, but the jury seems to have thought they were. Well, anyway.
We don't know what the jury thought, Your Honor. Nobody testified that those were her precise words. They thought she said words to that effect. So what if she says, my bosses won't be happy? It is a process within which one gives give and take. The issue is, did she do this for some form of gain? And I think that is some form of personal benefit. That is what this court in Bloom has said is the test that separates an ordinary breach of fiduciary duty from that which makes a criminal offense. And here, what the state or the government ought be showing is that she did not follow the criteria. Not that in applying the criteria and evaluating it using her experience and knowledge, she brought in other considerations that her experience and knowledge said were appropriate to use in evaluating these objective criteria. That, I think, is permissible. To say otherwise would make this court become a clearinghouse for three states' procurement processes. It would take, for example, a legislator who talks to a constituent who asks to see her. So she meets with a constituent. The constituent says, you know, I'm supporting this bill. I'd like you to vote for this bill, and here's why. And the legislature exercises her discretion about how to vote and winds up voting in support of the bill. Is one to come afterwards and say, well, gee, you know, you thought about the fact that if you voted that way, you'd get that person's vote. Is that the kind of personal benefit that can now interject itself into this exercise of discretion
and
become a criminal act?
Well, the government has the theory that her 50-cent an hour raise, if you will, bonus, plus the fact that the benefit doesn't need to go to her personally, that it's enough that the benefit go to somebody, and in this case there certainly was a benefit to Edelman because they got the contract.
That 50-cent an hour raise is disingenuous. The testimony is uncontroverted that another civil servant initiated the process by which she got that 50-cent an hour raise. She initiated the idea, not politically appointed bosses. And it went up through the process and finally got approved. But, you know, what I tell...
Had this not intervened, would that have been part of her base pay? Was this a one-year-only raise? Or how
no,
did that
the, work? The testimony was that merit increases are given, though somewhat reluctantly, stingily, if you will, by the state. Her immediate superior testified that she had worked on many projects during that year because they were short-staffed, had put in hours from 6 a.m. to sometimes 7 p.m., was there every weekend. She thought they ought to do something for her. And so she proposed a 50% increase, which she said was really...
50-cent increase, not 50%.
No, I'm sorry, a 50-cent per hour increase, which she said she thought was, you know, just a token. And that got approved. That was the uncontroverted testimony. It had nothing. There is nothing to link it to her outcome in this particular action of procurement. What I tell, you know, ever since this case, state employees come to me, and here's what I tell them. I tell them, whatever you do, don't sit on one of these committees. If you're made to sit on the committee, don't ever open your mouth. And if you do open your mouth, tell them that you're there to hack off your boss, and if in spite of that they give you a raise, turn it down. To say that someone ought be held criminally responsible because they tried to please their boss in a system where you hold out merit increases, which I hope, are given because you do good work and in the process please your boss. To say that those are reasons that the performance of a discretionary act can become criminal, I think defies logic. The bottom line is there is nothing in the indictment that charges that she even knew about the political contributions, and certainly nothing in the evidence which shows that indeed the evidence showed to the contrary. So what we have is essentially a retrospective view by the government in light of the government's finding out that there were contributions. And ascribing to...
These contributions were not illegal contributions, were they?
No.
They were within the limit that Wisconsin permits for contributions.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think this stretches both the notion of misappropriation of funds and the breach of a fiduciary duty of honest services beyond anything which any court has held to date. There is no pecuniary gain by the defendant. There is no gain in job security. She was a career civil servant. She was at the highest level of civil service. She could not get a promotion. There was nothing for her to gain personally by doing this. Indeed, the only thing that could jeopardize her career civil service status would be to do the very thing that the government alleges, that is, try and produce a reward for having made a contribution to the governor. So what happens here, and I think what this case illustrates, is that unless one holds the line, I think, as this court did in Bloom, that you will indeed become a clearinghouse for all kinds of retrospective looks at what government employees have done in exercising their discretion, where they are given that discretion, and second-guessing them in light of information that they didn't even know about at the time. I don't think that the criminal law is supposed to be a place where we get this creative with pushing what is a troublesome statute and concept to begin with. And I think that that's what this prosecution represents.
Thank you, Mr. Hurley. Mr. Henstadt.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court.
Mr. Henstadt, is your opponent correct that there's nothing in the record to indicate that the lady was aware of any contributions?
Of contributions specifically, that's correct. But there is evidence in the record that suggests that she's aware of the significant political connections that existed between Edelman Travel and the Doyle administration.
Now, you call those significant political connections, but the only thing I saw in this record was that the people who own this travel company had met with the governor. The governor agrees to go and speak at this 20th anniversary party for the company, which did not strike me as all that unusual a thing for a governor to do. Governors are political people. They're not like judges. They go and give speeches, you know, at parties if they want to. And the two owners of the company make contributions to Governor Doyle's campaign within the financial limits that Wisconsin permits. Now, I have to say, at least in comparison to some of the cases this court has seen, that's a pretty thin set of facts to show some tight political relationship between Governor Doyle and the people who own Edelman Travel.
But looking just at those connections, that may be true, Your Honor.
Is there anything else? Am I missing something?
There are her statements where she says that politically this won't fly. My bosses don't want to hear it's anyone
that
other than Edelman Travel.
That doesn't say anything about what Governor Doyle and Edelman Travel are doing, though. Those are extremely general statements. Is there anything else in the record to show links between Governor Doyle and Edelman Travel other than the things I've just reviewed?
No, Your Honor. That's it. But the fact that these links existed...
Why is there anything wrong with those links?
There's nothing wrong with those links between Edelman Travel and the administration.
Wouldn't you suppose that links like that would exist with many companies? Companies' owners often contribute to political campaigns.
Yes, Your Honor.
If they're smart, they do.
I'm sorry?
If they're smart, they do.
But it was the committee's function to insulate the contract award process from political pressures. And instead, what happened was that Georgia Thompson specifically injected those very political considerations into the contract award process.
When she doesn't even know that the owners of Edelman are giving legal amounts of money to Governor Doyle, when she's one vote out of a large, actually she's not even a voting member, right? She's an advisory member.
She is a voting member.
All right, so she's one vote out of a group of people, seven people, and she just says vague things like, politically, you know, they're not going to be happy with this in my office.
Well, she's also aware, Your Honor.
Just fade?
She's also aware, Your Honor, that in June of 2004, about 6 months before the RFP was publicly issued, representatives of Edelman Travel met with administration officials.
So and, what?
And gave them a draft request for proposals. That's unlike any one of the other proposers. No other proposer met with the Secretary of the Department of Administration.
Did you go after the governor and the Edelman people criminally?
No, Georgia Thompson was the only person that was indicted.
So the people you think were responsible for all this horse around are Edelman and the governor, but she carries the sack.
Well, it was certainly the focus of this prosecution, obviously, was Georgia Thompson. Again, it was her role as a evaluation committee member to insulate this process from political considerations. The fact that Edelman Travel has a political relationship with the Doyle administration is fine. That happens all the time, as Your Honors have noted.
And they're the low bidder, and the government's making this ridiculous point that the 21-point difference between Omega and Edelman and then the 0.7-point difference over a total possible of 1,200 means that somehow the process has been abused. I really have trouble seeing how Ms. Thompson did the things that 666 or the theft of honest services part of mail fraud.
Well, again, Your Honor, there are a series of steps that she took to steer the contract, and I think they all need to be viewed together.
To persuade the others. I mean, she had no veto power over that committee, did she?
No, not formal veto power, no. But, again, she inflated her scores for Edelman and attempted to steer the contract by doing so. When those efforts failed, she pressured the other committee members to change their scores, and she had opportunity to persuade them that they should change their scores on merits-based reasons.
Your position is effectively sold to your fellow members, and you think that's evidence of a crime?
Well, they didn't even change their scores, right? She says change, and they say, no, we're not going to.
That's right. She asked them to change, but, again, she does not say change because of this merits-based reason and this merits-based reason. She just says change. Politically, this won't fly. My bosses don't want to hear it. It's not going to be Edelman.
But is your point that she's not sticking – that's why I asked about Brad Pitt. If your point is that she's not sticking to the criteria in the statute, you would be prosecuting her also – if she had a crush on the Edelman representative because he looks like Brad Pitt. If your point is that there's somehow something politically fishy about this and she's trying to do a political favor through a very indirect route for the governor, it strikes me that your evidence is beyond thin. So I'm not sure what your actual theory of this case is.
Again, Your Honor, if you view any of these things in isolation, that may be the case.
Well, but what is your theory of the case? That she wasn't looking at price because the price was the lowest from Edelman? That she wasn't looking at service?
I certainly don't think that she awarded the contract or favored Edelman because they were the low bidder. Again, that was not a rationale that she offered to any of the other committee members.
So there's some subjective rationales that she might have causing her to lobby in a certain way that you think wind her up in a federal prison, and there are other subjective rationales unrelated to the merits that would not wind her up in a federal prison?
Well, again, I think that the test set forth in Bloom is the key here.
Is what I just said true?
That's right.
So if she has a silly reason, she likes somebody's hairdo or whatever, then she doesn't wind up in federal prison. But if she has a desire to do something politically pleasing to her superiors, whether she's right or not being another issue, then she winds up in federal prison.
You know, the Bloom standard
is
requires
right?
two
no.
things.
Is what Judge Wood just said correct from your point of view?
There are certainly some factors that would not wind her up in.
It's terribly easy to answer the question. Yes or no.
Yes. If
now could you articulate what that difference is? Because, I now get lost. The Supreme Court has a very complex jurisprudence, maybe even more complex than the arising under federal law jurisprudence that we were just talking about, about when states can favor domestic enterprises in awarding state contracts. The Supreme Court says you can't discriminate against out-of-state firms, but when you're awarding the state's own money, you can supplement in-state contractors or vendors. And it's very hard to tell the difference among these lines of cases. But it looks to me like you're saying if any state employee misunderstands that jurisprudence and favors a domestic contractor unduly, report straight to jail under 666.
Again, Your Honor,
can that really be right?
This is not a case where she simply misunderstood the criteria and failed to apply the criteria.
I'm not asking about this case. I'm asking about the legal criteria. Is it the government's position that any state employee who makes a recommendation on the spending of state funds where there's a federal supplement, which is this case, who misunderstands the appropriate scope of state, of in-state preferences, has committed a federal crime?
No.
And if your answer is no, tell me why that doesn't require this conviction to be reversed.
Because with respect to each of these two counts, it's not the case that Ms. Thompson simply misunderstood or wrongly applied the evaluation criteria. She made statements that she wanted the contract to go to Edelman Travel for political reasons.
Political reasons and support of in-state vendors are the same thing. In-state vendors are supported when states engage in procurement because it's politically smart to support the in-staters who vote and contribute rather than the out-staters who don't. There is no comprehensible distinction between politics and in-state favoritism. So you can't say your answer doesn't apply because this involved politics. It's just a non-distinction.
But also, Your Honor, if the criteria are simply being mistakenly applied, not being applied correctly, that is, if it's just a matter of ineptitude, that is not a federal offense. If, however,
what I now hear you saying is every time a state employee misunderstands the way the state procurement system works, it's a federal crime. And I take it that what would follow from that is that every time a federal court in an action under the Administrative Procedure Act, say, reverses a federal administrative law judge for not understanding the way the disability payment system works, the ALJ has committed a federal crime by misapplying federal funds.
Surely
you can't mean that.
I surely don't, Your Honor.
Other than your argument that there was a mistake of state law made.
Yes, Your Honor. And the other thing that we have here is private gain. That is, Bloom requires not only misuse of office, but misuse of office specifically for private gain. She misused her office. She abused her fiduciary position specifically so that a lucrative state contract would go to a politically favored bidder.
Back to my question about the Commerce Clause again. Most state employees think that they will get ahead by doing what their supervisor wants, and if their supervisor wants favoritism of domestic contractors, they think that will get them ahead. So we're back to the proposition that any mistake in favoring in-state vendors is a federal crime.
And indeed, there's evidence in this record that that's exactly what she thought she was doing. She says, let's keep this in state, and there's some words to that effect, and Edelman apparently is that kind of vendor.
Well, Your Honor, that was the explanation, that was the theory of the defense, is that Ms. Thompson and not the other six committee members was the one who was honestly applying the evaluation criteria.
I'm not even saying that. That may have been the theory of the defense. I'm just saying that there's testimony in the record that doesn't seem to be refuted, that she says we want this to stay in state. Now, whether other people care about being in state, whether the regulations need it to be in state, all the rest of that is another point.
But there were also other in-state bidders, and they weren't favored. The bidder who ended up being favored was Edelman Travel, again, the politically favored.
But Edelman was always near the top of the list, even if Omega was higher.
True, but the RFP itself in Section 3.2 requires that the bid be awarded to the high scorer. And at several different points along the way here, the high scorer was Omega. It was
and
not
she
Edelman.
Persuades them to think about it again. It winds up being a statistical tie. I mean, I just, as Judge Easterbrook said, significant digits do mean something. You can't increase precision by continuing to multiply decimals.
Well, but none of the other committee members felt that it was a tie. That is, all of the other committee members felt that when Omega...
Maybe none of the other committee members understood the rule that you can't get more significant digits out than you put in.
But there's
just
no...
Just because they flunked high school math doesn't mean a federal crime was committed.
But there's no provision anywhere in the RFP or anywhere else that that calls for rounding up or rounding down or provides some sort of window within which... two bids are statistically tied. It simply says that the high scorer gets the contract. And unless your honors have any further questions, I'll conclude by asking that you confirm the judgment of conviction of the district court.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Hunstad. Anything further, Mr. Hurley?
No, I think your honors have identified the issue, and if you have no questions, then I have nothing more to add.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.